Tuesday, February 9th. And the time is 9:10 a.m. and the 30-day disclaimer room in the office is now open to all. Members of Housing Education present are Co-Chair Representative Andy Story, Representative Mike Brown, Representative Ron Gillum, Representative Briar Hopkins, Representative Bob Fox, Representative Tiffany Hickok, he's on the screen with us, and also Co-Chair Representative Harry McDonald. Leaving room to conduct business before we begin, you know, the drill is on phones. Otherwise, I will be done at this time. Today, however, we have recording secretary is Lori Rowland, and Donald Peterson is our honorary moderator assisting with tech and teleconference and support. Thank you both. This morning, we are pleased to have Senator Baker passed Senate Bill 1003 and reduced tuition for essential workers. Senator, would you please come forward with your staff and come up with the bill? Name and affiliation, but not name in the presentation. Something potentially life-changing back to those frontline workers. Over the past few years, you know, the frontline workers have taken care of us, whether it's been delivering our food, making us up to the airport, cleaning our offices, exposing themselves to first, more virulent forms of COVID-19, and even now today we're continuing to do so. They have always taken significant sacrifices, something to bring this to themselves. Published by Occupational Biomedical Medicine Journal Employment, and I think you need to read through this. Over 20% of grocery store employees, for example, tested positive for the initial phase of COVID-19, and some newer second rates of 1 or 2 or 3%. 20% is your lowest income working for the most part. Those workers that were required to get a job health and staying in those jobs. Risky 10 free tuition for frontline workers is a great start. Or thanks to lots of support workers. During this COVID pandemic, many have fallen behind as we've learned more about the world that we've had. It's clear that we're in one community recovery. This bill is about giving these frontline workers an income as the best selves. As we take pride in what we can gather for financial support to those who wish to continue their education and prepare for the future, in this new world, continuing the world for opportunities. Stand from the U.S. Department of Labor for these counselors that higher education attainment equates to higher degrees as a builder for the new workforce where we're coming up. If you're more effective, you can make your relations manager after the session. It takes a median earnings for homes that just the high school diploma is $35,328 for the bachelor's degree, and on average, $57,708. This is a significant difference in that chair. Education through U.S. The same way report states that 96.3% of the graduates are Alaskan residents who went to school in Alaska each year in Alaska. And you know that even more than coming from the same to others from years that you know that that's true. And that is especially important to us. Furthermore, as we continue to care about teacher retention and our need to train and retain high quality educators, it is about those thousands of our professionals who sell college who are ready. This bill will help you. This bill will help you work towards the next year of their career. The plan of the African workers to earn a place in their education in Alaska will stop the attrition of Alaska's future. We know that the program must have been successful in ever since, but it is likely to highlight the changes made in the Senate Education Committee because of people's changes. We're going to build past with bipartisan support in the same Senate. First, drafting language was updated to ensure the grant program is available for all states going to post-secondary education programs, like ACTEC and the UN Certificate Program. can measure any eligibility criteria to allow folks who are laid off or to come up for some of the pandemic to be in the management program. Additional changes to eligibility criteria were made to include more comprehensive definitions of online essential worker, less qualifications around the record of the definition of essential worker, established for the March 27, 2020 health mandate from the government. The plan will allow essential services and critical workforce infrastructure to be included in the ability to provide comprehensive and repeatedly to the core of all people to work for all of us. This document that includes folks like medical workers, grocery store clerks, and providers, and many, many others. This is also an legislative legal choice to use the term essential workers to stand for the workers, more in terms of actually handling the physical database of information. And finally, program to program appeal dates are updated to reflect the limited nature of the program and the fact that it's only the limited grant or the opportunity to apply to this one program is limited to a couple of years, and the opportunity to use it as an event is up to 4 years. I want to just point out two things about that limitation. And I think already all the things will need to be revised again. One thing about those limitations says is that there's a cap to what can be spent. Number one, if they spent $2.5 million up to 4 years, it's a total amount that was appropriate. And then funding source is not huge enough. Our funding source is, quite frankly, COVID resources. And the reason why it's COVID resources came out of our Senate Finance Committee, because this is probably the most direct thing we could do with our COVID resources to actually address what we are building under legislation in this group. We've got a conversation earlier to listen to you over here on the Subcommittee on Education Policy and Law and Affairs, retaining funds and education in the Department of Education and Learning Development. There are also funds in other contracts going up, of course, $450 million in ARPA funding, sitting in this legislature. And it's our intent with the Finance Committee's intent and the Senate's intent that this bill would be funded with those resources. And it's, I think, we're coming to you in that. So, what could we use? This time with every funding original request or appropriate. Because we can't, there's flexibility to. What I think we have here is an opportunity to use it when it is a third way that is expanded by the program that has been accepted to the public as well as to those who are impacted. So, with that, I will turn it over, unless there are questions, I'll turn it over to the next deposition of the attendant in reaching the session. And I'll take you back to the chairman.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you for your guidance. I'll be reading from a section of analysis and for the identification of essential workers. This is version 13-LS-027-NA. From 15 minutes, we'll talk about the dates for the grant program and for people who are established on the first session of the 37th century of the ADT opinion. So, section 1. Establishes an essential worker and laid off worker grant program under codified law of the state of Alaska. Section 1 directs a lack of permission on post-secondary education, or ACPE, to award grants to essential workers or folks who are temporarily or permanently laid off from employed at the start of or during a declared federal public health emergency. Section 1 also directs ACPE to establish policies and procedures for application and admission to the grant program, including outlining several additional eligibility requirements, including residency requirements, requiring completion of the free application for federal student aid or FAFSA, eligibility pertaining to pre-need education payments, and admission into a qualified program. ACPE must consult with the Department of Health and Social Services in reviewing the Alaska Essential Services and Criminal Relations and Protection Required, originally introduced on March 27th of 2020 in a timely and published early. Finally, Section 9 includes necessary definitions of terms used under the grant program. Section 2. Establishes an essential worker and laid off worker grant program report under codified law of the state of Alaska and directs ACPE to submit the report of program efficacy to the Alaska State Legislature on November special analysis. Is that a good one?
Thank you. Senator Davis.
Thank you. I will talk to the Senator The section change is important, personally, that all the pieces should just go to the program and be added links to their data as we go along with the point of our acting chiefs.
There are some people online for House Bill 272 and 273. We will only be dealing with Senate Bill 10 this morning, but we will be, these bills will be heard at 3:30, not this morning. So if there's anyone who's online for that, you're welcome to stay and listen to this conversation, but call back this afternoon for testimony or listening to the two bills, 272 and 273.
I think that concludes the presentation. There's a special note, and we do have some minor testifiers that were under the confidence of the reference site of the Senate for District 10. And so at this point, unless there are questions, we are all at once.
Thank you. All right, I see a couple of hands. Representative Cox and then Representative Roberts.
Thank you, Co-Chair Coleman. Mr. Chair, I understand your point. The dome of workers are essential. Because we're going to do it, we're essential to somebody. So, I guess my concern is maybe this is broad enough, it appears that this will be perhaps to attend certified educational institutions. And when I was working in medical and also in the insurance industry, I recall hiring people who had bachelor's degrees or people with a master's degree for retail operations. They didn't have a degree that applied to their resume or find to it. And then offering it to some insurance, you don't need to go not only for me. Four-year degree, maybe the passing test, in those institutions that provide that specific training and capability, or somebody might just need to know how to use Microsoft Office Suite. And those, by several companies, and they're going to provide that sort of thing, very specific, detailed training, they're not associated with the college board. But it seems that that would help these folks more. And being able to for your program. Can we advise here, or is that my comment?
Through the chair, or something, for the record, I'm going to pass it over to Ms. Davis, and the officer to detail and defer to the question. But the answer, the short answer is yes. Consideration in Senate Education Committee was quite mentally finely attentive to our condition to graduate, perhaps suffer unemployment or partial unemployment as a result. So we're trying to think about some expanded national degree using both that and our early college geographical semester programs and other open student programs. But those are both a part of our ability to answer the And the reason it doesn't require any of our is because there are other programs that are going to look at in this committee or other committees that are wholly suited to the community of the especially if you can program and to launch an open capacity. So what we're trying here with this bill is to focus on a limited amount of money so as to not to cause the administration of unemployment just to let this test and then also to make sure that those that are most deeply affected by this particular pandemic are very resource to perhaps change their experience. And that said, there's some detail on the journal matter. I don't know how long you've talked about the question. I'm just going to
So, there is a possibility, I guess, under this bill for the OAS being brought for some of the secondary education to perform a program that helps you pass the insurance exams. Because I don't believe that it's currently running through the university's specific certificates or licensing grade.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. So, your central theme for all of this bill is to get people in grade number for your degree. And just kind of like simplify it, maybe it's that like, in the chair.
Thank you.
Big Mac here. Thank you, Mr. Albert, for bringing up both of them. And if you really feel better with next one, but if you feel these are our thoughts to permanently support recovery from the pandemic going forward, it's one of the best ways we can have a long term impact on this one and a positive statement and watch them at this beautiful. So thank you very much. Thank you for bringing this forward and helping all of you here. I'm just going to kind of bring on the phone for moving on the card. If you don't graduate here from your program, you don't have to be immediate funds, you don't get the skills that you've developed, you are able to travel those forward and use those going forward. This theory is a very good idea. Representative Rapp is absolutely right. I mean, you know, I don't know what your experience or other committee's experiences have been with college education. I can only reflect on my own, which had the hard paths or future improvement they were telling us when I actually couldn't compete to what I was arguing when I had done that. But I mean, I believe that was the case with a number of siblings as well. So it does involve not only in this realm, it may be with the scholarship program. I don't give up absolutely clearly $5,000 a year in that scholarship program. I often get a letter from a student, maybe one out of two names from that board that's selected that year saying, I'm unable to compete with the program, but I have to return to my answers now. And if it's like, if that's part of my disability draft, sometimes you aren't able to do that. If you can be paralyzed for it, you will receive your second year under that. But you will not, be paralyzed for having life circumstances compound around that. So I would just suggest that your analysis is right on the button.
Thank you, Sean. I appreciate that. And it's good to hear that. I strongly agree with all of that here.
Looking at page 2, lines 10 through 12, otherwise, they're afraid of equivalent academic abilities, specified by information or regulation. Some of those things have not been written, of course, but what are GED comparable things?
I'm not sure. I don't think I don't have to say it, but I think it's pretty obvious, but it's therapeutic. I believe they looked at what I think perhaps there's a WEDs but Sandra is on who would suggest the best perhaps you could answer that question. I just think you would. But I think that's a very good question. I think they want to point out the state of Michigan, they have similar to this one that they passed. This one is focused on higher education, and I've talked in that back in many of the certificates and that kind of thing. They use almost 10%. It was 10% of their population planning that extended all the way down to complete, including high school. So, yes, this would not apply to this bill. And the reason why it would have been too large, and it was based upon age, I think, the reasonableness in terms of how they have saved their family over the last years. I was wondering if it were possible to try to figure out what became it as opposed to what we have here. It's not you would say that the narrow focus, the clear intent of this bill, is meaningful, not meaningful labor, but meaningful power around it. Any other sort of potentially that may not be this before.
Can we come out and to that item before the board of that forward and last down in the water if it's happened, but it's certainly our love of transportation and people who can get their some knowledge for the wall, some of the 90 credit hours gets people back in, 9100 gets people back in the support to address that grant and move forward. Thank you very much.
I would only add that on line 9 of page 2, it refers to getting a GED. So we tried to do that same thing. Thank you for your questions from the committee. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Chair. And we have another question. Just a comment, I appreciate that you have the FAFSA being required to fill out because what I have been learning is that you do not really have federal dollars to come to you to help you with your education. And so I should get some people right now who have been getting our visiting grant award that they are because that's correct, we're the one with federal dollars. And we are the largest state that makes federal dollars on the people that we do their use for education. So thank you for that. And you have a couple of letters in here by, you know, certain requirements that people have to have, which I think is really important. But overall, I think what I've been seeing on the subcommittee is that we have a hearing
day to day or night to night. I see this as just part of a piece of the puzzle to help us in our workforce. Are we too old or not to take down or appreciate these efforts?
So thanks for your attention to the industry. Because there have been an additional period for this bill to break out and get their reactive pieces of the training and certifications. Certifications that had been advanced in the years, just a few days ago. I brought this bill up at that time because one of the problems that we're going to face with the new federal infrastructure that we put out, the bipartisan infrastructure legislation in New York, Washington, that is going to be phased out of the state over the next 5 years, but we do not have a trained workforce to deal with them. So this bill actually makes it this a small part of that, but it does offer one additional tool to our residents, to our citizens, to try to take advantage of the jobs that we're trying to get at this state. Otherwise, we're going to have to pay for high school workers. That's not my intent, but I know it's not anybody else's intent. If this can help build that, if it can provide jobs from the rural after or rural hospital to all of those very young people, then let's take advantage of the opportunity to try to take it up.
Thank you. Thank you both. We will now move on to invited testimony. In our esteem, we have Ms. Sarah Perlin, Government Relations Manager at the University of Alaska. I'm delighted to see you. Sarah, put your name and affiliation on the record, and I understand you're going to give us the PowerPoint presentation.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Sarah Perlin, Government Relations Manager for the University of Alaska. Thank you for making this second term topic. Thank you for having our session today. I'm going to take a few minutes to talk about clinical development, and I will also just be telling you where we're going and what's going on our Alaska HR workforce. Just to say, just to briefly explain to you, I'm going to provide a brief overview of the University of Alaska and how training in Alaska's workforce is a critical part of our mission. I'll talk about the value of post-secondary education and the topic of the university's role in boosting economic recovery by strengthening our workforce. Going to slide 10, first I'd like to say thank you for the recommendation of staff faculty for carrying the tracing and carrying this bill. The university supports this legislation and we recognize it's a key role in strengthening the workforce. As we mentioned, just one also open to story we're discussing. We've got significant gaps in our workforce right now. I think in the last 2 years, it's really highlighted how fragile the Alaska workforce is. As we go through, we point to the great resignation, we have to the great reconsideration. We are seeing employees leave the workforce and give us either by choice or working hours. And several employees are asking to consider reconsidering their former paths. At the same time, we're seeing holes across all of our Alaska industries that are investing in retail and hospitality, skilled labor, professional services, healthcare, and also, again, like this conversation is just super up in the stand. You know, we are certainly post to see significant unemployment here in the next 5 years, and we look towards our workforce and say, are we remotely prepared? And so we're being interested perhaps some options. So we look at the pipeline as a real opportunity to find more Alaskans, which both strengthens their personal lives, but also improves our state's economic outlook moving forward. We're finally graduating to our presentation here. Slide 2 is just a quick overview of the state and where we are, where the University of Alaska is. We've got three separately granted universities, University of Fairbanks, University of Alaska Southeast, and University of Alaska Anchorage, with those associated with them, we have 13 community campuses and several additional education centers throughout the state. And it's fair to say that we are statewide, and then I'd like Dr. Brown did the long and most comprehensive report ever in the state. Look at the last one. I mean, there are our first training, that is, that's called a lot of years to say, actually, with the is one of the most important of five identifying strategic goals. The University of Health offers more than 200 programs, and there are anything from career and technical certificates to associate degrees, all the way through bachelor, graduate, and PhD degrees. And if you're finding out that those degrees, some of them do directly towards meeting our person's needs and all those products for the drawing engineering or even healthcare, these are all areas that we're seeing significant demand from all the employers that need our posts to meet that need with our 200 plus programs. Moving on to slide 4, can you talk a little bit about the value of the retribution? And how do you use that slide to show the median earnings? Looking from Boston with a clinical degree all the way up to graduate professional degrees, you see that the lower is that as we graduate from the median earnings of 5,000 dollars a year, whereas those with graduate professional degrees are $130,000. More than $30,000 increases from $7,000 a year. And I should note for reference that the average wage in students goes just over $60,000 to $59,998. There's been looking at this, you can quite clearly see the correlation between higher education and improved earnings, plus upward mobility. And we also have evidence to show that the higher education, the lower the employment rate goes throughout the state. Sorry. Yes, thank you, Chair. Thank you for your presentation today. I just wanted to add that an online university certificate programs my certificates. It's like that, but it makes it significantly more with getting your certification and going back to work. That's again some of the bachelor's degree or associate's degree. Just wanted to find out this. Chair, thank you for putting that out and observing on the record here. That's a great point. You know, we see all the resources that we're going to get into the community. Just speaking of how much we need to get our own time to share our world, that's a critical opportunity. And we're very fortunate to be able to train the thousands to do that. Here are the next slide 5. We're going to look at wages here. This is a snapshot of 10 years. This is 18,000 university housing graduates. I'm sharing the first year is falling from the starting line. Again, the underlying rebash line really represents the approximately $60,000 average loss of wage. When students leave the university, and this is for all of our programs, not just in graduate degrees and bachelor degrees, but all of our programs, the average wage is $50,000 for the bachelor in the first year. 5 years later, it's almost $5,000 to just under $70,000 a year, which is $10,000 more than the last average wage. Again, I think this data shows pretty clearly the value of higher education, post-secondary education, and the value it adds to all the middle class and the class. Again, the upward mobility and really the capacity to grow and the health of others. Moving on to slide 6. I just want to briefly take us out. The university worked with the Department of Health, Labor, and Workforce Development. That was actually spot on last 2 slides, came directly from Department of Labor and Workforce Development. We worked with them and put together 9 industry workforce boards. These are industries that the university greatly supports. Administration of finance, aviation, construction, research and learning centers, health, information technology, mining, oil and gas, and teacher education. These workforce reports cover several outcomes that put together the overall outcomes including those industries, the average wage, and the projected trends for those industries, including what the executive hiring is for the next decade. It's our next slide. I just want to make a point that if you assess, if any of our peers are doing a follow-up questions like that, we're more than happy to learn and those will be published and
Thank you.
that's not what he wanted to do. So he said he'd draft it. He couldn't have known if I hadn't said he'd draft it. He was now a train and a mechanic. And he'd been a damn fine when he had it. And whatever was going to happen at the beginning, programs like SB 10 will give people those opportunities to get themselves up and moving forward. Half of us hanging out with statewide, we support anything to give the person an opportunity to go to work. One of the corrections that I'd like to make on a couple of statements has been made. We, right now, have not got enough workers in this state to do the jobs that we're doing, trying to get done now. What I'm trying to find is a plumber, electrician, truck drivers. They're in mind. If we don't start training our own, we're not going to get anything done. And then the fact that we have this billions of dollars coming into the state, and we don't start training some folks up, we're not going to get done. Because every state in this, in the whole country, is going to be competing for workers to do that, because they're all going to have the same opportunity for those funds. So anytime we have an opportunity to train somebody, let's take it. I think this is a great program to do that. Okay.
Any questions, Mr. Etheridge? I'm glad you brought up AFTAC. I had the opportunity to tour AFTAC several years ago, and what I learned is that every single student that comes out of that program has a job waiting for them. In fact, there are more jobs available for those students than there are students completing the program. So that was 8 years ago. I can imagine that it's only gotten the need has only gotten.
Well, I'm not sure in forestry, but now as a fire chief, I don't understand.
We are continuing with this morning's meeting. We worked this morning to end this morning and held it for further consideration. This afternoon, we will be considering a different set of bills. And I just wanted to catch you up. Lori Rowland is our reporting secretary. Lydia Klein is our MIO and Tom Conkins and our veteran. Thank you both for that. Members of Council of the King present right now are co-chair Representative Andy Stewart, Representative Matt Crock, Representative Ron Gillen, Representative Mike Cox, and we also have co-chair Representative Harriet Turner. This afternoon, we will consider Representative Stewart, House Bill 272, and time permitting House Bill 273. Both bills relating to the base student allocation. First off, House Bill 272, which is brought forward. Representative Stewart and staff state your meetings and affiliations for the record and begin your presentation.
chair Griffin, and thank you, members of the Health Education Committee. Good to see you this afternoon. I'm very proud to represent District 34 here in Juneau. And our producer is Alex Factor, and he's very presentation because we think it tells our story best now. And so this PowerPoint is intended to provide you the big picture of why a bump to our people funding is critical at this time. Inside your bill package, you will find supporting documents for the bill. And I am calling this bill, I put it into it, I'm calling it BOOST. Based on attention for student excellence. At the proposal, Erin and I will be happy to answer any questions following our review. We're not needing to do that twice. So, anyway, we have to emphasize two words here. Maintain, which means to keep something at the same level. An obligation we are not meeting, and the word all. This is especially challenging because all kids arrive at different readiness for school. But our Constitution doesn't say we only serve the kids who pass us for us to do so. Next slide, please. Bottom line, education translates into an economic investment. It's a form of infrastructure and requires maintenance. Over time, it erodes. As we have heard in this committee before, we need to invest in our children today to build tomorrow's workforce. Our economy in light of the May 2020 trends issued by the Department of Labor that points out that our population is aging and retiring from the workforce. We need every one of our youth to be ready to fill these jobs for our economy to thrive. Next slide, please. This bill is not a major overhaul or a huge hype. This simply helps communities, educators, schools, and our kids keep up as costs rise. And it will start a 2-year planning window of predictability. This is key to keeping static as the budget amount mentioned. The budget amount, the intention of it, is known in districts and award contracts that will be my advances. More time can be spent on student learning and redoing budgets. Next slide, please. It's important to understand that while the legal center has increased dollar amounts over time, in real terms, education funding has declined nearly 10% over the past decade and adjusted for inflation. Next slide, please. BSA increases that this bill is proposing make up half of the lost education funding that has been experienced since the BSA was last increased in fiscal year 17. Just to let you know, we'd like to get some amounts for this bill. After the first year, the increase would take the $30 million that was outside of the formula and vetoed in fiscal year 20, and we put that back into the BSA. And the inflation proof from fiscal year 21 and 22 to come up with a fiscal year 23 amount. We then, for the second year, inflation proof that amount for fiscal year 24. Our inflation proofing is based on the consumer price index for urban Alaska from the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics. After consulting with the Legislative Finance Division, they said that would be the best reflection of the Alaska economy.
This question represents a story. I'll say it on the slide. So in other words, even though inflation has gone up 8% in the
2016, $17,500 is an average per pupil education spending cost in Alaska. After adjustments, Alaska's per pupil education spending is $11,997, slightly lower than the national average, $12,201. This ISTAT adjustment is similar to the way the PSA is calculated. First, the education cost will adjust the fairly increased cost of living index. Then, because the cost of Anchorage is higher than other cities in the United States, and most other cities in the United States, then this number was adjusted again to account for the increased cost of smaller and more remote districts.
What's that story? What works out of Brock Series? Do you see what the story I'm talking about? So, what's that Brock story?
I think it's about I just wanted to clarify the statement on slide. If the thing that Alaska is spending $17,500 in today's dollars would be adjusted for inflation. And that would be since 2017, I'm guessing. It's actually the equivalent of $12,000 in $2,017.
I think that this is a very expensive schedule that I'm showing now through the chart of Representative X. So what this actually is the use of inflation adjusted out. The last is CPI compared to the value of the dollar and the lower 48 cents fee. So the dollar is higher by some limit. And the Indiana's out. And so if you're looking at this, you know that how it costs more than a person to buy a beer or a dollar or a beer and that'll be if you're not in Missouri. It's the US will cost more. So what I sort of did was they averaged this based on
it's hard when Representative Fox is to your right and Mike is in front of you, so, but that would help our moderator consider it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. One last slide, please. And this is simply a chart that I sort of put together and in your bill packet there is a paper about this chart. The cost of education in Alaska, and I said we'll be testifying after we do this. So, next slide, please. So, this is about what drives the cost, and I said we'll be talking about this more because I've studied this, and now we've got things that will have these drives to everyone here. Alaska has a higher amount of small schools, vast even market differences. In our smaller schools, we have a few that went to and been educated in other homes. We have a few other homes. This is Alaska, our court place, and the middle of the schools and the heart of our communities. And also, districts that maybe are state administrative experience, personnel, voluntarily, that we do honor and have also come on my passenger line, and I find it very interesting that schools do not benefit from the public policy equalization fund. So these were rural energy costs, and frankly, all of our costs in Alaska are higher than the national average. And then, of course, our health care costs are the highest in the nation. And so that relates to expenditures that are not in the classroom. And of course, they benefit our teachers by having health benefits.
And also, I'd like to point out that one of the places why was further up in the deck. It is that now, just keep your eye on the projector, and you'll be able to find the energy. Questions on this one? You proceed.
Hi, I'm Samantha. This is the last day. Funding goes to kids. Investment in our children is really an investment in their future. It's an investment in our future workforce. It meets our constitutional obligations to maintain our public schools for all kids. I really urge your support of this proposal. This base allocation was due in 6 months. So thank you for your questions. And I don't know what is your comments now, or we do want to do a grant testimony, or you have some available to go to the section on right now, sectional analysis and fiscal notes.
Yes, let's do that before we go to the final testimony. And then we'll have questions from the community, and then we'll want to go to the testimony after the presentation of the session.
Doesn't really matter because everybody's
sending emails. So, and in the car built in 2017, wasn't really comparable to a car based on price. It's the same model of car, I don't know, it costs more than what it did in 2017. And I don't think the different bells and whistles and whatnot. And how that applies to the school. First, you're not buying milk, you're not buying things off the consumer price index for providing educational services. And the increases in technology and whatnot have to be taken into consideration. And so I don't think that we should just rely on statistics like that. And I disagree with the interpretation of the constitutional requirement that maintaining and keep talking the same. They didn't mean that, but they meant that. If we should be providing the same level of services and acceptance in 1956, no. Or whatever the model expresses, should we provide the service the same way that was provided in that handbook? That's not a useful way from the perspective of this stuff called education delivered to students. There's no, now we could, the state could meet the constitutional requirement by developing a statewide course, transmitting in a matter of summer VHS dates as far as that goes. We don't want to do that. But I think it distracts from what we're really trying to do, which is to provide education, a certain level of education, but not yet a legislature. And when we do that, it won't be one of which the solution that has to be done is going to be funded. But it isn't an unlimited commitment to providing more something that has to be kept in mind when there's a lot more space for them.
Thank you, through the chair. Or perhaps I'll take the previous comment. It wasn't meant to, when I say maintain, I'm looking at school costs, which we will talk about, health insurance, we talk about fuel, these are all things that are based in the districts, they're out of the district's control, and so they have increased costs, and so when we keep the base utilization flat, that leads them to the service that they can provide for the children who are really not maintaining what they were able to do before. Certainly, they don't need to integrate to districts are doing that. But I think what's going on today is we'll have fire tax running, we'll have several superintendents at home who can talk about these fixed costs and how they grow our ability to maintain what we are offering. And what, how we need to be nimble and respond to, you're right, how the world changes. And we certainly have plenty of documents about the DSA over time, many more years, and we're happy to give you a follow-up.
I don't want to say that you have to challenge that, so you can leave it. It's beyond the control of the school districts. It's not. They have a certain degree of control over all of this. I'm going back to the postage example. I get continued to write letters and send letters, and I have to change over to email. I can adjust the way I do things. The school districts have been doing that to a certain degree. But it isn't completely out of their control. And then assuming that we have no obligation to go any further than that, what is out of our control, what's our need or somebody's control. So I don't think we should accept that answer, respectfully.
Thank you. Yes, I appreciate those comments you're making. I do realize that they have to get the building they've got and, you know, turn the heat off. They have to work fixed and they have to pay for health insurance. And I think this is what districts have invested some costs that we're looking to try to get lower costs in certain ways. But overall, and I think we'll have our speakers a little bit more on this discussion. So thank you for sharing your thoughts.
Excuse me, I have a parent engagement that I have to teach on after. That's what I'm saying.
Can you hear me?
Thank you. Mr. Zaroff. So, this is David Zaroff. Are you able to hear me?
You can hear me loud and clear, and I don't hear feedback.
Okay, then, through the church, should I begin?
Yes, please begin. I love your name and your patient, and I love the beginning presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. I apologize for the technical difficulties. Through the chair, my name is Dana DeFeo. I represent the University of Alaska Anchorage and the Institute of Social and Economic Research, where I serve as a diplomatist, and I direct the Center for Alaska Education and Policy Research there. I'm joined by two co-authors of the report that you've been looking at, Matthew Berman, who's a professor of economics, and Diane Hirschberg, who's a professor of education policy and the ICER director. I've been asked to ask a couple of issues around public spending on K-12 education. So what I'll talk about is what we pay and how that compares to other states and some of Alaska's unique education costs that affect that comparison. So to the first question of what do we pay, as you were looking at the report, the last time we formally compared Alaska's per pupil spending to other states was 2019, and we used 2017 figures. And in 2017, our per pupil spending was 46% higher than the national average. We were the sixth highest in the nation. But the latest numbers available are from 2019. And looking at those this week, they show that Alaska is still in sixth place. The per pupil spending is now only 39% higher than the national average. And as you remember, in 2019, the lower economy in the lower 48 was growing faster nationally than it was here in Alaska. And so some other states were able to invest more dollars in education. So we do spend less proportionally now. But I think the question is, one of the questions is, do we really pay that much more than the U.S. average? So in raw dollars, yes, we do, but everything in Alaska costs more. I'm in Arizona right now, and $20 buys more here than it does in Anchorage where I live, and it buys even less in Nome. And we're not only talking about, the bags, we're talking about things that some of those states need to purchase, too. So we do need to make some adjustments to make a fair comparison between Alaska and other states. In the ICER report that you're looking at, we made two adjustments to the buying power of the dollars that we spend. So first we used the foundation formula, the geographic cost of rental, and that was weighted by the district average daily membership to level the differences in costs within Alaska. And that adjustment alone, which was adjusting Alaska communities to Anchorage, that explained half of the difference between Alaska and other state spending. After those adjustments, Alaska was spent 22%. Above the national average. But then we needed to adjust Anchorage dollars to the nation, and we did do that using the cost of living index. And after the second adjustment, Alaska costs were actually 2% below the national average. And that was in 2017, and as I noted, since at least in 2019, and likely since then, Alaska was falling further behind. I also wanted to speak to some of the unique education costs that we need to keep in mind for Alaska, three unique funding challenges that are particular to our state. Number one is that Alaska has a lot of small schools, and we talked earlier that there is a legal and ethical responsibility to provide public education to all students, and there were three major cases between 1975 and 2004 that defined that responsibility quite clearly. So we have small schools, and they're costly to operate. For small class sizes and smaller communities, they don't benefit from economies of scale when we're talking about capital and labor costs. And the second cost, and I also already mentioned, is healthcare. Alaska has the highest per capita healthcare costs in the U.S., and that's bad for all sectors of our economy. And so while the challenge of high healthcare costs is unique to education, it affects education because in a fixed budget scenario, what happens when the districts have to pay these costs is they put downward pressure on wages, and that makes it harder for districts to offer teachers a nationally competitive salary. And the third thing that I'll mention is energy. Energy costs are high, and they've been rising, and there's two things I'll talk about here. There's first fuel costs. These fluctuate over time, but fuel also costs different amounts in different places. It costs more to transport and to store fuel in small communities. In some communities that lack, year-round road or water access, that's more costly. And communities might not get the best price, so they have to make bulk fuel purchases. And then the second part of energy is electricity. And electricity costs in remote places can be 3 to 5 times higher than it is in other communities. And school districts, as was noted earlier, don't benefit from the power cost equalization programs that reduce those costs for residents. So regardless of how much
school districts require a lot of building buildings in older communities, and they need electricity to operate those buildings regardless of how many students step on one of those spaces. So it's kind of 5 minutes, I'll wrap up quickly. And so in the analysis that I've done with my colleagues, Alaska is now an underserved in public education. When we adjust the spending to make a fair comparison to other states, we spend less than the national average. So to that, I'd like to speak briefly about the school funding formula and how that fits in. It's been analyzed, and even with the geographic cost differential, it needs updating, and that is a separate issue from what we're talking about today. But we do have this formula that works to distribute the available funds that we have equitably among Alaska school districts. And how big that base pot of dollars needs to be is what we're talking about today. So in addition to the discussion about the base allocation, I'll note that, you know, the state of Alaska has not had an education spending yet, but they still need to, you know, empirically explore what we need to invest in their public education to make sure that we're providing the services that would enable students to be successful. So we really need to look not only how much we're spending, which is what I talked to today, but, you know, what we're spending these dollars on and making sure that we're providing adequate dollars to ensure that Alaska students and teachers and schools and communities are set up for the best possible education outcomes. Thank you. That is correct. It was the report, I think. Oh, I'm sorry, through the chair. That is correct. I believe the report is called How Much Does Alaska Spend on K-12 Education? Thank you.
My name is Jamie Burgess, Superintendent for Non-Public Schools. Good afternoon. Chair Story, Chair Garland, and members of the House Education Committee, and thank you for the opportunity to testify. This is my third full year as superintendent and my fourth year developing a budget for my district. I'm here to express my support for House Bill 272 and to share with you some other reasons why the flat funding situation in the past 6 years has created a budget crisis. For example, our property insurance premiums have doubled from 6 years ago, partially due to claims coming from systemic failures in our aging buildings, such as earthquakes and civil rights failures. Since we have not had a single capital project budget since 2016, we anticipate continued similar problems, resulting in continued claims and therefore continued premium increases. Since there are only two municipal insurance entities in the state of Alaska, we don't have an option of simply looking for a different insurance carrier. We also see the impact of climate change here in Northwest Alaska, with severe winters bringing strong winds and bitter cold, resulting in high heating fuel bills for this current year, and with increase in the cost of oil, we anticipate very bad costs in the years to come. We've been incredibly lucky that the pandemic has created an unexpected flattening in our health insurance costs this last year, and many of our staff simply put off medical procedures. However, we're seeing that even with the pandemic continuing, health care for this current class have risen dramatically, and we're being told to expect at least a 10% rise in our premiums for this next school year. In addition, our purchasing power for items such as textbooks and classroom supplies has dwindled over the past 6 years, so we get less each year for the same amount of money. We've used our COVID funding to create incentives to recruit and retain both our classified and our certified staff in the current labor market. Our COVID funding is going to run out very soon. The lack of pool for our educators is looking extremely grim. The competition for the best and brightest educators is fierce, and Alaska is no longer competitive as it once was. Our retirement plan is no longer attractive to younger teachers, and our cost of living, expensive travel, and scarcity of housing are no longer offset by our high salaries. Enrollment in middle has dropped just enough that we're receiving some full-time funding to cushion the drop. But FY23 is going to be our last year to receive this funding if our enrollment pattern continues. We've moved some of our key student behavior supports positions into our COVID funding, but that will be gone in 2 years. Many of these positions will also disappear unless another source of funding can be found or general funds are increased. Some of the positions which need the most are Alaska Native students, such as a second cultural arts teacher at a middle high school, and a PAC speaking aids and our fledgling and working diversion elementary classrooms. At a college and career guide, I now am relying on outside funding from our travel partners unless annually we request it. The travel organizations ask me, why are these positions not funded out of our general funds? And I have to answer them that I have to prioritize teaching positions which allow us to offer classes for children to meet our state graduation requirements, which is truth as an answer, which doesn't allow me to fail, but I need my board's mandate of endorsing the system's academic needs. It makes me feel that I am feeling that failing the Alaska Native children in my district. I know we are on behalf that we must be accountable for doing well with the funds that we already receive. I'll be honest with you that in the past 2 years, I've seen teachers, support staff, and administrators every single day who have innovated, who built relationships with students and families to keep them coming to school, who have returned to my district after two of the craziest years ever in education. We recognize that schools and education are absolutely crucial to the future of our students, our communities, our economy, and our country. We deserve the support of our legislators as we continue to work hard to recreate our education, and I believe that House Bill 272 is an excellent start. I'm grateful to those in the House and Senate who continue to be strong proponents of our educators, and I hope that you will move this bill forward with your full support. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much, Ms. Burgess. I would like to ask you to please email that most excellent testimony to my office. Staff to bring the right email address, but in the meantime, it's rep.harriet.durland@ukfudge.gov. Anyone else who wants to give you their testimony, really appreciate your very excellent testimony. Any questions for Ms. Burgess from the panel? Okay, thank you. Appreciate especially the people returning to your community after
Because of the continuous increased cost in food and shipping,
CARES Act and ARPA funds that we've been able to cover these costs through 2024. But these are only one-time funds that are going away. Before I reach my closure, I would like to tell you about the cuts we've had to make because of FAP funding. We've cut pre-K. We've cut CTE, career tech ed, and reduced our counselors by half. We've cut all elementary and middle school student activities and greatly reduced funding for high school activities. We've had to make cuts in administration, the teaching and support staff positions. It gets pretty difficult to sit in a meeting trying to balance the budget, deciding whether we are going to feed or educate our children. We have experienced the continual rise of inflation while funding for education remains flat. With a decreasing value, we are diminishing public education, giving our students less opportunity. It is time to address education funding and inflation-proofing the BSA. If we don't, we are hurting Alaska's students and our state's future leaders by not fully funding public education or accounting for inflation in the state education budget. Thank you for your consideration of HB 273.
I'm
happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much, Superintendent Walker. Really appreciate your down here. Any questions for Superintendent Walker of Northwest Ohio Public School District? All right, and you're a homegrown superintendent. I am a precious commodity, and I really appreciate your commitment to your community.
Thank you.
And we want your testimony too. Scott McManus, Superintendent of Alaska Gateway School District.
Hello.
Hi. Put your name and affiliation on the record. You have to go.
Thank you.
Tell us who you are once again.
I'm Scott Brown, Chicago, Washington. So, a couple of years ago,
other testifiers. One of them is in the room, so I'm calling right now. And I know that there may be one or more questions. Bridget Weiss. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. On the record, my name is Dr. Bridget Weiss. I am the superintendent in the Daniel School District. I am also the president of the Rodeo Alaska Superintendent Association. And I thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. I am here in support of Hospitals 272 and inflation improving the district allocation for public education. In this general district, the effects of inflation have been felt as we prepare our budget each year. And with the 7.2% CPI increase in the last year, public schools are left again to make tough decisions as we prepare our budgets for the next fiscal year without the success of this bill. Over the last 5 years, public education has received flat funding, while the fixed costs of running our schools have seen significant increases. This results in declining funding. We have made adjustments. We have lost counselors. We have lost health team members. We have lost larger class sizes. We have made many adjustments in our schools, and those adjustments are hurting our children. In 2017, the price of water, sewer, and telephone services in the general school district was $396,000. And for FY22, those same costs were $464,000, an increase of 17%. The price of electricity and heating oil in 2017 was $1,258,439. In FY2022, the cost of electricity and heating oil was $1,527,200, an increase of 21%. Property, liability, auto, and cyber insurance premiums for the school district in 2017 were $606,588. In 2022, those same things were $995,600, an increase of 64%. The projected cost for FY2023, which we are now currently trying to budget for, is $1.5 million. This is a 155% increase since 2017 and a 55% cost increase over the last year. The current budget proposal for education funding does not account for inflation. We know that this results to a decline in funding given our basic costs, those things that we cannot adjust, continue to rise. My school district will be expected to find the funds to pay for the increased cost of insurance, utilities, and supplies, while ensuring our staff have a living wage. All of this is the same funding we've received since 2017. We've been doing more with less for years, seeing inflation continue to rise, but funding for education remains flat with a decreasing value. We are hurting Alaska's children and our state's school leaders by not fully funding public education or accounting for inflation in the state of the education budget. I myself am a product of Virginia's placement. I am now leading our very important work. I'm doing that in large part because of the learning opportunities and the high quality educators like I experienced in the general school district. Please help us keep delivering our robust education for our future leaders. Thank you for your efforts and thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Weiss. Really appreciate your testimony today. Let's hear that. I believe we have one more person on for invited testimony, and that would be Lucy Raytown. Is that you on Teams? You need to unmute yourself. I can't see that. Are you on the screen? There's no other in speaker. Let's see if we have you. So I hate Teams. I can't see. I can't see me. There's no ball from here. Okay, let's take it quickly. I think I got them off, does it?
So, for the record, I'm the current members of the Dewitt County School District, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak up here on behalf of the 8373. First, Cook is
convention that I called in for 2023, but they are very similar, and we are in support of both of the bills. And primarily supporting the bills because they provide a consistent, reliable, and predictable avenue for the state of Alaska to invest in the education of our pre-K through 12th grade students. As the committee is fully aware, the base student allocation has not been addressed by the Alaska legislature since 2017. School districts across the state annually need to develop budgets that address the ever-increasing fixed costs that are embedded within our budgets, but annually reduce the amount of funds we can dedicate to classroom instruction and improving the educational context we provide all students. A couple of examples which are very similar to what you've heard before. Medical insurance is one of the most significant fixed costs within school district budgets that increases annually. To put medical insurance in perspective, medical insurance accounts for more than 12.5% of Gretzky School District's annual budget. Our insurance increased 5.7% from FY21 to FY22. The 3-year average percent increase annually has been 5.41%, and the 10-year average annual increase has been 4.27%. Heating fuel has increased 24% since FY2018, and the freight for food service has increased substantially just in the last year, 6%. These annual fixed cost increases continue to erode the monies available for school districts to address the learning needs of our students. HB 272 and 273 provide a regular, consistent, and reliable mechanism for the state of Alaska to invest in the education needs of our children. Additionally, HB 273 eliminates the annual legislative battle required to address public education funding each year and will provide the legislature the opportunity and space to proactively address other significant needs across the state. Thank you for the opportunity to provide a testimony to both of these bills and open any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. I really appreciate the testimony. And if you could, email your testimony to house.education@akmh.com, I would appreciate it. Any questions from committee members for Mr. Wright? I believe we're done with our invited testimony. Mr. Wright, I do have a question for you. You are in the city of Craig, not Montgomery Island. Correct?
Yes.
Yes, correct. And right down the street, I've been to Craig, but I've been to Montgomery Island. It's been a number of years. But right down the street, the community of Colwell is in the Colwell School District. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Do you have any way of taking advantage of joint ordering of materials or supplies with that school district in order to take advantage of being able to order a larger amount and dividing the tank?
We haven't explored that. The majority of our freight comes in on barge, and so that I don't believe there would be much of a saving by just putting them together. And it might be save a little bit in the cost of what we're purchasing, but it wouldn't save much in regards to the freight being here.
Okay. Anyone else have questions? All right, thank you very much, Mr. Martin, and the other invited testimony. We will now open public testimony. We have quite a few people on the phone or on the floor who have been with us the longest. Charlene Arnstein. She left, okay. Let's try Corey Fields. Ms. Corey, go ahead and put your name and your foundation on the record and go ahead with your testimony. I'm just going to give you a couple of minutes because we have a lot of people and not a lot of time.
Thank you. I'll be quick. For record, my name is Corey Fields. I'm from the Republic of Alaska, from the Oracle System School District, and speaking from our household system. In making the best student allocation, it is essential for all schools in the right state, especially important for our rural schools. Many of us have no local borough or municipality to support their operations. Rural schools rely on our state funding. For 3 years, it has made it clear that both of these businesses have soared as prices increase. We are also
Thank you. Thank you.
Mary, I need you to wrap up your comments. We have others waiting to speak. And you can email your comments to us at house.education@indylife.gov.
Thank you so much to the House of Education Committee for taking testimony on this very important subject.
Thank you.